Let's Talk PR and More.
Public relations, media, publicity, integrated communications, marketing, digital, reputation management, and more.
Let's Talk PR and More with award-winning PR strategist Sherry Goldman.
I'm Sherry Goldman, president of Goldman Communications Group, and welcome to Let's Talk PR and More. My guest today is Michael Vergentino. Mike has worked in most aspects of public relations. He's worked in corporate PR for companies including Canon and 3M. On the agency side, handling PR for a range of companies, including helping Isuzu Motors enter the U.S. market, and for nonprofits, including the American Red Cross of Greater New York and the Mary Knoll Foundation. Mike is a history buff, and he's integrated historical perspectives into many of the programs he's led, whether it be commemorative programs for milestone anniversaries or to support programs that have a long heritage, as he does for clients including the Civil War Roundtable of New York, Revolutionary Westchester 250 and W3R, and for Freedomland USA, an American history theme park in New York, about which he has written several books. So I'm so excited to welcome Mike to the show today. Welcome, Mike.
Well, thanks, Sherry. Good to be with you.
Tell us a bit first about your background. I know you and I worked together probably hundreds of years ago, I think. But as I said briefly in your intro, you've worked for agencies, corporate nonprofits. So tell us a little bit more about your career path and some of the things you've done.
Well, I decided back in the 70s that I wanted to go into some form of the communications field. And my original goal was journalism. And I worked on the student newspaper at my high school. I grew up in the Bronx, so I went to high school up there. And then also got involved in a television program that was done through the New York Archdiocese. I went to a Catholic school, and it was more a closed-circuit kind of student news program. And I jumped on board with that and then went over to Fordham University, where I received my journalism degree, but really went there to spend all my time at WFUV, which was then a student-run, almost a completely run student-run station, to really learn the tricks of the trade to become a better writer. And then from there, I went into broadcasting for a short while at New York City and suburban stations, and then dovetailed into public relations, which I was doing a little of when I was at the Fordham station, because in addition to doing my on-air news reporting, I was also in charge of promotion for the station. So I was able to get a flavor of public relations in college. And then, as you had mentioned, pretty much doing a lot of everything, corporate, agency side, nonprofit, during my PR career. And whenever I talk to students or high school students, college students, I always tell them, go somewhere to start your career where you can do a little bit of everything.
Such great advice.
Now, that little bit of everything, more than what we did when you and I first started, but it's do a little social media, do a little magazine typewriting, do a little news release typewriting, learn how to work with photography and now videography. So I always tell people, dabble in everything. Get as many different experiences as you can, and then 3, 4, 5 years down the road, really then set your voyage on where you want to be, where you want to fit in. But at least you have all that experience behind you.
It certainly helps. And I know during your career path, you've done a lot of corporate social responsibility work. I think, in fact, you and I at different times both handled the CSR program for Canon. I know I managed their Clean Earth campaign and supported initiatives for them for the National Parks Foundation, the Nature Conservancy, and the World Wildlife Federation. What did you do for them?
Right. Well, when I was at Canon, I started off on the PR side, working for video cameras and printers and copiers. But then the corporate social responsibility area of corporate communications, which I don't recall the name, but it wasn't known as CSR at that point.
No, it wasn't. That's for sure.
Yeah. A couple of people in that department said, can we get a little more attention for the programs, for these corporate programs that Canon is involved in? But I always like to try something new, experience something. So I said, well, if we can carve out my time, I'd be happy to help in that area. And then having done that for about 2 years, along with my additional PR work at the company, the manager of that department decided to leave the company, and I just slid right into that position. So not only was I managing the programs, but I was also handling all the communications for the programs. And
fabulous.
Some of the ones that you just mentioned, we also did work as a sponsor for Nature on PBS. We did a high school environmental program competition for the U.S. and Canada called the Envirothon. We did Canon Scholars. They were doctorate students from all over North and South America, involved in various areas of environmental sciences, and we sponsored them and would sponsor about 80 a year, and that was a wonderful program that Canon did, I would say, for into 15 years. And then locally, as you mentioned, we get the employees involved in a cleanup crew, your springtime and in the fall, going out to maybe Jones Beach and cleaning dunes out there, or going to a local park and prepping it for the summer, just to get the employees involved in some of the corporate work that Canon was doing as a very responsible environmental steward.
And that's important for a company to do, to really not only talk the talk, but walk the walk, but really do give back to the community, give back and be a good corporate citizen.
Correct. And in addition, when I was at Canon, just didn't work on environmental programs, though we've chatted about several of them. One of the big programs we were involved in was the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children.
Oh, wow.
And we came up with a very novel program to promote not only our relationship, to promote the importance of finding these abducted children. Canon, as part of its sports sponsorships, sponsored several professional golfers on the PGA Tour and the LPGA Tour. And what we devised is that in every tournament that these golfers would play at, on their golf bag would be placed a picture of a missing child from that area where the golf tournament was held. And we called the program For Kids, four as in golf term four. And in each area, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children got us a photograph of a missing child. And then we promoted that the day of media day for each of those tournaments, and the golfers were able to talk about the importance to them of finding missing children. The PGA golf happened to be a new father. The LPGA golfer had several young nieces and nephews, and the children were important in their lives. So that was just a natural fit, and we received media attention in newspapers, on television, radio, all across the country.
It sounds like a phenomenal program.
Cover pages of sport. The New York Times, the cover page of the sports section, would cover it.
It is a phenomenal program, it sounds like. What a great way to sort of integrate doing good into a kind of a sports sponsorship program. I love it.
And the people at the Nationals were so wonderful to work with. Of course, their heads and their hearts were always in the right place. But it was even more fascinating and more rewarding when on several of these occasions with these golfers, because of the publicity in the local market, several children
were. They were
so
found?
It just made it more rewarding.
Oh, how great. I love when we can do something in PR that really does make a difference besides just promoting products. So you really did save lives and make a difference.
Oh, yeah. And it was just a phenomenal opportunity that not only for the program, for the golfers, or for the corporate, the executive suite. It was really championed all the employees, and not only here in the New York, but Canon has had offices all across the country. And it was just supporting to everyone when a success story, came true.
I love that. That's so great. I hear the passion you have for it. And I know one of the other things you have a passion for, Mike, is history. So how did you become a history buff? And then I know, as I said in your intro, you've done such PR for such interesting historical kind of clients. So how did you become a history buff?
Well, as I said, I grew up in the Bronx. And when I was about 7, 6 years old, in my neighborhood, they placed a theme park. It was built by the same gentleman who built or helped Walt Disney build Disneyland.
Wow.
And then he went out on his own and started creating his own parks. It was called Freedomland USA, and it was a theme park based on American history. So it was right in my neighborhood. I would see it almost daily, even from a distance, and went to it often as a child. My parents would take me there, and I just became passionate about history, whether they were the cowboys in the shootout have, or the Pony Express, or other parts of American history. That as I got older, high school and then college, I just decided to take more interest in my history classes, especially American history classes. And I just became very passionate about learning more about our past from the Revolutionary War times right up until the present at the time. And luckily, when I began working a little bit in broadcasting, eventually into PR, there were instances that called for historical concepts to be brought into stories or into programs. And whenever that opportunity came up, whether it was about American history, I would, I would be the first one to put my hand up and say, I want in on that committee, or I want to get involved in that program, because I just ended up having a passion for history that this park kind of sparked in me. And what was interesting, after going to the park about a year, and they had a huge Civil War attraction at the park, because this was in the early 1960s, and that was the centennial commemoration of the American War. A few years later, my parents, on summer vacation, took me to Gettysburg, and my father said to me, remember in our neighborhood at the theme park, they had this Civil War attraction. This is the place where it actually happened.
Yeah.
And, that was just a wow moment.
It tied it all together for you, huh?
Exactly, and it just snowballed from there. I'm a big Revolutionary War buff, as well as a Civil War buff. I'm a past president of a Civil War organization. I write about history. I'm involved with Revolutionary War organizations, because we're coming up very close on the 250th anniversary of 1776. So it's just part of me. And I was able to work it in, especially in the PR side, work it in sometimes with clients, not necessarily American history, but their corporate history. And I found out, which was very interesting and a learning experience for me, we celebrate here in America 25, 50, 75-year anniversary. Well, when I was at the public relations firm, International Public Relations, which was the first real professional PR position that I had, we had a lot of Japanese clients that were bringing their business here, such as Isuzu and Fuji Bank and other major corporations. To the Japanese, the 60th year is the important year.
60? Why is that? Never heard that.
60 is just something in their culture. Even when I always asked, a lot of these executives could not explain it. They just see, I think it's they see 60 in their personal lives as the generation.
Okay.
You know, we say 65 for retirement age, but they pinpoint 60. So 60 is not only important for them in their personal lives, their 60th birthdays, but in the lives of the corporations celebrating a 60th anniversary. They're not necessarily 50 or 75 like us. So it was very interesting to work with several companies that were going through that 60th anniversary, and they wanted, of course, they were doing big things back in Japan from a corporate standpoint, but they wanted to do some things here, either with the media or with the business that they were involved in. So that was an eye-opener for me to get involved in programs such as that.
What's the challenge of doing public relations for a milestone or a commemorative kind of in a historical event, you know, for the 60th? Because that sounds like, you know, the company should market and celebrate it. And I think in today's world, you'd put a lot of content on social media about it and things like that. But certainly in terms of getting media relations, what were the challenges did you find?
Well, for Japanese clients, they were very humble. They would just make sure it was stated, it was known. They might have some private events for clients or top customers where they would just do a private celebration. They weren't so much into the publicity aspect of it beyond their circle. American companies or American organizations, very different. as an example, I would have done, when I was at 3M, I would have been involved in major anniversaries or milestones for such as Scotch tape, post-it notes, you know, these big consumer products,
right,
where a company would want to put a lot of promotional dollars behind that, whether it's branding on the product themselves, on their advertisements or so. But we would also do it in PR. And in PR, it was a little more difficult because you really are talking about the product and the things the product can do. And, oh, by the way, we've been here for 50 years, or this product has been on the market for 75 years. Or in the case of Post-it notes, we would do a 10-year milestone, and or maybe a 20-year milestone, because that product just became so hot and took off so quickly.
Interesting. And I know I want to circle back to one of the things you mentioned earlier, how you grew up near Freedom Land, USA, and it was a hidden treasure, so to speak. And now you're actually doing PR for Freedom Land, USA. You've written books about it. So tell me more about, you know, you've taken that childhood fascination and love, and this is what you're doing now.
Right. Well, if anyone knows the Bronx pretty well and knows where Co-op City is,
I was just
going to
ask you, where is
years.
It? I, you know, drive through the Bronx a couple days a week to go teach at City College. I go through the Bronx. I know the Bronx well. I had no idea where Freedom Land was or is.
All right. Well, Co-op City was in between the New England Thruway and the Hutchinson River Parkway, where they cross over there in the Northeast Bronx.
Okay.
And it was a park, we mentioned earlier, was based on American history. It was 85 acres of attractions.
Wow.
Which was huge at the time. The park was open from 1960 to 1964. And why 85 acres was huge at the time is because Disneyland, which opened in 1955, was only 65 acres. So this was the next leap in theme park, mega theme park attractions and becoming larger. The park only lasted for 5 years because, unknown to any of us, children and to our parents at the time, it's an ulterior motive for the land. The land is marshland. The bay that Eastchester filters into Long Island Sound, but then you have land in that part of the Bronx. Well, in the late 1950s, or really in more the mid-1950s, the city planners and the city politicians knew that the city was going to suffer some economic downturns in certain areas of the five boroughs, parts of Brooklyn and the South Bronx. And we all know what happened to those during the 60s and early 70s. Well, they wanted to keep the people who were jobs, the tax base, in the city. The city planners had to come with new housing, modern housing, not like the apartment housing that they had built after World War One. And in order to do that, they decided to build several housing facilities in the city, Sarat City in Brooklyn, Rose Village in Queens, and Co-op City in the Bronx.
Okay.
But they couldn't build Co-op City because the Army Corps of Engineers said you have to wait 20 years and test the land because it's marshland. So someone twisted the arm of the Army Corps of Engineers. They cried uncle, and they said, okay, if you put something on the property that lasts 5 years without any structural damage, you will get a variance to these large apartment buildings after 5 years. And that's why Freedom Land only lasted 5 years. They brought the creator of the park in to put the park on the land, and they deliberately drove the park into bankruptcy to last the 5 years to obtain the variances to build Co-op City, which now houses about 15,000 people. I think it's the world's largest cooperative housing project. So there was a lot of shenanigans involved. You had people like Robert Moses involved, William Zeckendorf, who's a big wheeler dealer real estate person at the time. State and local city politicians were involved. So there was a lot of shenanigans going, including involving the pension fund of the Teamsters Union. So all of that was not known to me. I was just thrilled about the park, and the park sparked my interest in history. But I decided about 14, 15 years ago, when Facebook was first starting, I would see that there were a lot of interesting Facebook pages besides what we did as individuals. You know, there was a Coney Island page.
Right.
There was the Best of Brooklyn page. There was, you know, everyone had their interests. And I said, well, there's nothing about Freedom Land.
So it stayed with you, and you really decided you were going to get it out there, huh?
Right. So I decided with the Facebook, said, I have a bunch of photographs. I can probably do good research since that's what I did for a living. That's what we all do
right.
In PR. We try to do the best research we can. And I found a lot more photos. I found some people who had worked at the park, their information. And I just didn't want to post a picture on the Freedom Land Facebook page that said, you remember this attraction. I went into who created the attraction. How did it, why did they go that way, in that route, you know? So I would find as much information as I could. And it started taking off because the prime people who were interested in Freedom Land were from my age bracket were the baby boomers.
Mm-hmm.
So it started taking off. And then over the years, it's expanded to Twitter, Instagram, and a couple of years ago I added a Pinterest platform to it. And it just started taking off. And then
and you've written books about it.
Yeah, well, 6 years ago, a good friend of mine who started as a sports and travel editor and then became editor-in-chief of the Staten Island Advance, who I did some work with from a PR standpoint
Leyline?
Over the years. What was that?
Is that Brian Leyline?
No. It was somebody else
okay.
Who has since retired. And as a matter of fact, I think he when he became editor-in-chief, he stepped into some of Brian's shoes.
Right, I know Brian. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And he was a Disney fan. And he had, when he was handling travel for the Staten Island paper, he wrote a lot about the Disney parks, the opening of Disney Paris, and et cetera. And I didn't realize that he was originally from the Bronx. And he wrote a book that compared the similarities among Disneyland, Walt Disney World, the New York World's Fair, and Freedom Land. So he interviews me for the Freedom Land part of his book. So he submits it to the publisher, and the publisher says, this is great. we need to add one more component. We need to have someone write a foreword for your book. Do you know of anyone? And he asked me. So the publisher just loved the foreword for the book, and he says to the author, how well does this guy know Freedomland? He wrote a foreword. You quote him in the book. He says he's like the de facto historian on it. So the publisher says to him, well, you think you can have him call me? There's no book about Freedomland, and Freedomland having the Disneyland connections, a lot of people would be interested in it. And the publisher, not knowing I was a writer, I was in public relations, that I could do this, I could do the interviews, I could do the research and put the book together. So five and a half years ago, Freedomland USA,
the definitive
history, is published, and all of a sudden, everyone comes out of the woodwork.
How fabulous.
Once they see this book. I had interviews with some of the younger employees. I couldn't speak with any of the management people. They had all passed on by this point. I had to do a lot of digging, a lot of research. Who was involved with the park? What were companies involved in creating the attractions? And one lead would lead to more leads. But when the book comes out, the floodgates opened. I'm contacted by 50, 75, over 100 people who either worked at the park as teenagers or young adults, or their children whose parents have passed on the story. I thought I had found everything I could about Freedomland because the records no longer existed. The files were gone. But with these employees contacting me, I even found four or five archives around the country that had material from some of the corporations that were involved. Park.
Michael, that's
so that
fabulous.
Set up another book that just was published earlier this year, and it's Freedomland USA, More Definitive History.
Perfect.
And it's just packed with information.
Great. Listen, we're almost out of time. So I'm going to say my takeaway from this is, number one, when somebody asks you to do, someone gives you an opportunity, jump on it, because just your writing the foreword enabled you to now be able to write two books on Freedomland, which is fabulous. But how can people find more information about Freedomland USA? I think that's...
Well, the best place is to go on social media.
Okay.
On Facebook, it's Freedomland USA, the world's largest entertainment center. The same for Pinterest. And then it's at Freedomland USA at Twitter or on Instagram. And they could always email me. It's very easy, freedomlandusa@yahoo.com. I post pictures from anyone who finds photos in their archives, family albums. We post plenty of those pictures, as well as many others that I've collected over the years, as well as we post a lot of memorabilia and other information about the park.
Sounds great. Mike, thanks so much for taking the time to come here today. I love talking to you, and I hear your passion. It's so phenomenal.
Well, thank you, Sherry. Love the work you do. And
thank you.
Let's get the young ones up and running in the wonderful profession that we enjoy so much. We just pass it forward to them and let them run with the ball.
Sounds great. Thanks, Mike. That's Let's Talk PR and More for today. You can find more information about the show and about me at Goldman Communications Group's website, www.goldmanpr.net. And if you want to hear this show again or any past show, you can listen to the podcast, which is posted on Goldman Communications Group's website, as well as on most podcast sites, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, and iHeartRadio. Thank you again for listening. I look forward to talking PR and more with you all again next week.